I should think, like most people that listen to this podcast, I often sit there in my armchair thinking about those lads that went off to France and Belgium in 1914 and the years that followed. And I wonder what they were like. And I also wonder what they would think if they could see us today, visiting the battlefields, reading and listening to podcasts like this, Tales from the Battlefields with me, Terry Wenham, watching TV documentaries, or standing in silence at our local war memorial on Remembrance Sunday, or standing at their grave, or gazing up at a name or a memorial to the missing over 100 years after the armistice. Would they realise the depth of our understanding and appreciation of their sacrifice? Would they despair of the world today that seems to have understood little from the bloody passages of the past? Lawrence Binyon wrote, "They went with songs to the battle. They were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end against odds uncounted. They fell with their faces to the foe." And for many years, I thought that perhaps he'd written that after the armistice, at the end of the hostilities, when peace had returned to Europe. But it turns out I was wrong, because Binyon wrote those words in 1914, just a few weeks after the outbreak of the war. The slaughter on the Somme and the horror of Passchendaele was a long way off. That last line I just read there, "they fell with their faces to the foe," but most of them hadn't yet fallen or sang their way into battle. Perhaps Binyon was predicting the future, not reflecting on the past. Those boys, would they believe the sight of those enormous silent cities like at Tynecott, beautifully created to resemble English country gardens? Those boys, as they lay bleeding into oblivion or drowning in a shell hole at Passchendaele. An English rose casting a shadow over their final resting place, even if their remains were often just partial remains, buried in long lines of trenches. There are no answers to these eternal questions, not for us in this lifetime anyway. These are just thoughts that I jotted down the other night while sitting there, as I often do, looking out into my own garden, thinking of those boys far away. And I came across this passage recently. It was written by a German artist called Kathy Kollwitz, who'd lost a son. And she wrote that the British cemeteries seem brighter, more cheerful and cosy. "I prefer the German ones. War was not a pleasant affair. It isn't seemly to prettify with flowers the mass deaths of all these young men. The cemetery ought to be sombre." And they are, of course, the German cemeteries, very different to ours. Neither is right, neither is wrong. It's just different ways of commemorating, of remembering. What would they think, those defeated German lads that lie in the mass graves at places like Menin, Fricourt and Langemark? How can we comprehend? It's now getting on for 25 years since I first went to the Somme, and 45 years since I paid a fleeting visit to the Menin Gates as a rather shallow 15-year-old. But to be honest with you, I don't understand what went on any more now than I did all those years ago. You would probably need a vivid imagination to turn those black and white photographs into reality in your mind's eye. My imagination doesn't stretch that far. I don't know whether yours does. Wilfred Owen, one of the Great War poets, he wrote to his mother in 1917. He said he'd noticed a very strange look on soldiers' faces up at Tetapla, a base camp. He said it was an incomprehensible look, which a man will never see in England. It was not despair or terror. It was more terrible than terror, for it was a blindfold look, without expression, like a dead rabbit's. It will never be painted, and no actor will ever seize it. And to describe it, I think I must go back and be with them. And of course he did go back. It's Tetapla now, if you go there, Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery is peaceful. All that's there now are the headstones and the ghosts of the broken men that passed that way. And in that particular cemetery, there are many women too, victims of the flu pandemic and also of aerial bombing in 1918. The other thought that I can't square off in my own mind is the thought of these fine young men from these highly sophisticated countries like the United Kingdom and Germany and France and Belgium and the other Commonwealth countries killing, maiming each other. Men and boys that they had so much in common with. Henry Williamson, great war veteran, writer, he said he came across a Saxon boy, crushed under a shattered tank. He was moaning, mutter, 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 mother, 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 out of his ghastly grey lips. A British soldier wounded in the leg and sitting nearby, hearing the words and dragging himself to the dying boy, takes his cold hand and says, "All right, son, it's all right. Mother's here with you." And of course that lad died. That's that compassion from one soldier, one human being to another. A relationship that we can relate to rather than killing each other. A man called Arthur Bryant, he saw it a little differently. He said that German civilians sang specially composed hymns of hate against England. And in the most civilised country in the world, quite inoffensive English gentlemen and ladies who'd never seen a blow struck in anger, scouted the very mention of peace and spoke of the whole German race as they would of a pack of wild beasts. Only in the battle line itself was there no hatred, only suffering and endurance, death and infinite waste. The civilians weren't on the front line, were they? Between 1914 and 1918. They didn't know what it was like. We don't know what it was like. But they did, those boys that were there. That's why they met up for decades after the war at the old Comrades Association dinners. And that's why we hear it so often, don't we? He never spoke about it. People say, well, how could they talk about it? So in this week's episode, I couldn't make up my mind what to do. These are just thoughts, as I said, that I've had over the last few days about this vast subject. So what I've decided to do is just pick out a few stories that I've picked up along the way over the years of some of those incidents that took place during the Great War that maybe don't help us understand but help us remember, I suppose. That's one of the reasons why we do this podcast. And to start with, it's really a follow-up from last week's episode when we talked about the young man Fred Frost from Harpole who served on the Western Front and was wounded in the German offensive of 1918. We talked about how he returned home to his wife Irene and they had a son called Roy, very sadly died of disease in the Second World War. And a couple of days after the podcast was published, I received an email from a man also called Roy Frost. And that's because he was named after the Roy Frost that had died of disease in India and is now buried in Bangladesh. The Roy Frost that wrote to me was in fact his cousin, And he told me that he'd always known about Roy. And he was born a couple of years after Roy had died in 1945. And on his 18th birthday, he was given a gold ring that had actually belonged to Roy. And was actually given to the original Roy on his 18th birthday as well. He went on to say that he didn't at that time realise the anguish and sorrow that his cousin's death had caused his aunt and uncle. I suppose, like all things, it's only in later life that you can understand what's happened in the past and understand your own feelings, isn't it? And Roy said that the podcast had given him a lot to think about, and one day he would like to join us on Terry's tours and go and see Roy's grave in Bangladesh. But there is another extraordinary coincidence, because in that cemetery in Bangladesh, there is another burial that Roy would like to see. And the grave there belongs to a man called Harold. And Harold is his wife's uncle. It's a small cemetery. There's only a few rows between Harold and Roy. I doubt whether they've known each other in life. They certainly wouldn't have known that they would become related through marriage after their deaths. How on earth did fortune and fate bring them together to be resting in peace, just a few yards apart from each other? So the first story that I wanted to share with you this week comes from a newspaper called the Kent Messenger, local newspaper from the southeast of England, and is dated January 1915. So it's talking about a situation that occurred very early in the war, when the enormous trench system had yet to be fully developed, and many of the civilians hadn't yet evacuated their homes in northern France and Belgium, and were therefore themselves in the eye of the storm of the advancing German army. It's quite a candid, frank letter that he wrote to, I think, a lady that was his girlfriend. This is what he said. "I called in at the supply depot to see a pal, and whilst we were talking of how much longer the war would last, we had a reminder that the enemy had not run out of their Jack Johnsons." Jack Johnson was the nickname given to a shell that produced black smoke. "They are awful things. The first one burst in a field 50 yards away, and it was as though an earthquake had come. The earth shook tremendously. Two or three soldiers were standing in the field not far from where the shell burst. They went over like ninepins, but luckily were not hurt. There was a rush to see the damage, but there was only an enormous hole 4 feet deep. It was whilst the crowd were watching this, another came, which scattered them always. It burst just over the housetops. At the same time, half a dozen of the same kind burst further up the street, reducing the houses to a great heap of bricks. It was then I thought it time to depart from such a stormy atmosphere, so I ran for my rifle and my pal picked up his. We were not the only departures. There was quite a confusion of horse flesh. Owing to fright, they got unmanageable and tore along the road to safety, perhaps. As we got further along, we saw the lads from the trenches helping each other along under the pain of frostbitten feet. Smithies with their aprons on and hammers still in their hands had in their excitement not thought to get rid of their aprons or tools. Regiments marching this way and parties marching that. French citizens hurriedly packing their belongings. No time for sorting out. Just the basket and the bundle, and perhaps never to see their home again. For if one of those beastly things hits the roof of the home, it is in utter ruins. Thus we leave the village. Rather an assorted throng, officers in motor cars, dispatch riders on motorbikes, mounted troops, troops on cycles, troops marching in parties, and some in twos and threes. The most heart-rending scene is the poor citizens staggering along under the weight of their bundles, with their feet ankle-deep in mud. No smiling faces. It's not the time for smiling now. It's the time for safety in hurried departure, when shells are bursting and screaming all around. You can hear them coming, but I can't tell where they are coming from. And all around, when that screaming sound is heard, for death lurks in the end of its journey. Well, as we retired from the village, the Germans seemed to know that we would retire in the direction we took, for the shells were bursting all around us. They sent us a few shrapnels, but they did no damage at all. It was those big black dogs that did the dirty work. One of the lads on the station was unfortunate to lose his head, which was taken off by a shell. But those who were not bound by duty to remain in a certain station or spot were far better off. For as soon as the sound of one was heard, they lay prone on the ground or in a ditch, anywhere from the flying debris, which was thrown in all directions. Well, we got out of the danger area and thanked our lucky stars too, but wondered how those who were still in the village were faring under such a fire. It seemed as though every house would be put into ruins. We got down the road for a mile and waited, for the Germans had ceased firing, and we thought of returning the same way for camp when they started again to shell us. That was enough. We made up our minds to return to camp across the fields. On our way, we watched the shells tearing the ground up and saw the houses blown high into the air. I fully expect some of the refugees who left that day will return only to find their once cosy homes a mass of bricks in the street. The firing started about 2 p.m. and in all 68 shells were fired on that undefended village. Because of censorship, Corporal Woollett, Stephen Woollett, he couldn't say which village that was. But as we now know, all of those villages that stood in the way of the Great War in northern France suffered terrible damage. Some of them were removed from the face of the earth completely. I wonder whether those people, those citizens, as he called them, ever did return to their homes, and if they did, what did they find? Now, as you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to set this podcast up in the first place was to look at the story of the Great War, not through the history books, through the eyes of the soldiers that were there. And I found here an article that was written by one of the senior officers of Brigadier General J.H. Morgan, who'd been a lawyer in civil life, but gave up that career and joined the army in 1914. And as we'll see later, his legacy to history didn't end with the armistice in 1918. He played a prominent part in the historical events that came after the armistice. But in this account, he talks about what it was like to be in the trenches, the effect of the German artillery bombardments, and the difficulties in finding your way around the trench system. First of all, in his first section, he discusses the effect of those dreaded artillery barrages, which the soldiers called crumps. He said the best thing to do on such occasions is to obey the nursery rhyme and open your mouth and shut your eyes. The intake of air will relieve the pressure on your eardrums. I've been told by one of our gunners that the gentle German has for years been experimenting in order to produce a frightful and intimidating a sound by the explosion of his shells as possible. He has succeeded. Cases have been known of men without a scratch laughing and crying simultaneously after a too close acquaintance with a German shell. The results are, however, sometimes disappointing from the German point of view, as in the case of the soldier who, being splattered with dirt but otherwise untouched, picked himself up and remarked with a profound contempt, "The dirty swine." The immediate approach to the trenches is usually marked by what sailors call a dodger, which is to say a series of canvas screens. These do not conceal your legs, and if you are exceptionally tall, they may not conceal your head. Your feet don't matter, but if you are wise, you duck your head. 9 out of 10 soldiers take pride in walking upright and will laugh at you most unfeelingly for your pains. Once in a communication trench, you are fairly safe from snipers, but not, of course, from shrapnel or high-angle artillery fire. A communication trench, which I visited when paying an afternoon call at a dugout, was wide enough to admit a pony and cart, and, as it has to serve to bring up ration parties and stretcher bearers as well as relief, it is made as wide as consistent with its main purpose, which is to protect the approach and to localise the effects of shell fire as much as possible, the latter objects being affected by frequent traversing. So what he means by that is they didn't build either the frontline trenches or the communication trenches, which connected the frontline support and reserve trenches to each other. They didn't build them in a straight line, because that would mean that any shell fire or rifle fire could go straight down a trench. They built them in like a zigzag fashion. That's what he meant by the term traversing. To reach the fire trenches, he says, is easy enough. The difficulty is to find your way out of them. The main line of fire trenches has a kind of loop line behind it, with junctions and small depots in the shape of dugouts. And at first sight, the subaltern's plan of the estate was as bewildering as a signalman's map of Clapham Junction. And the main line is complicated by frequent traverses. A survey of these things makes it easy to understand the important part played by the bomb and the hand grenade in trench warfare. For when you've taken part of a trench, you never know whether you're an occupier or merely a lodger until you've fully explored what is behind the traverses to the right and left of you. The delivery of a bomb serves as a very effective notice of ejectment. The back of the trench is protected by a ridge of earth commonly known as a parados. My servant, whose vocabulary was limited, called it a paradox and was not very wide of the mark. Somewhat behind the trenches at varying distances are the batteries. The gunners affect orchards and copses as affording good cover for their guns, and if none are to be found, they improvise them. Turf emplacements are constructed for the six guns, and turf dugouts house the telephone operator and the gunners. The battery officers are billeted some way back, usually in a kind of farmhouse. He then goes on to talk about some of the arrangements for evacuating the casualties from the battlefield. And he talks in particular about a phrase that's caused me, and I know many other people, confusion. A phrase called a field ambulance. He says that field ambulances, like the batteries, are somewhat migratory in their habits and change their positions according as they are wanted. But a field ambulance is not, as might be supposed, a vehicle, but a unit of the Royal Army Medical Corps, the RAMC, with a major or a colonel in charge. The ADMS of a division has three field ambulances under him, and when an attack in force is projected, he mobilises these three units at forward dressing stations in the rear of the trenches. They are a link between the aid posts in the front and the collecting stations behind. From the collecting stations, the wounded are sent on to the clearing hospitals and thence to the base. It sounds beautifully simple, and so it is. The most eloquent compliment to its perfection was the dreamy reminiscence of a soldier I met at the base. He told him, "I got hit up at Wipers, sir. Something hit me in the head, and the next thing I knew was I heard someone saying, 'Drink this,' and I found myself in bed at Boulogne." Every field ambulance has an attendant chaplain, and a very good sort he usually is. If the soldier is sick, he visits him. If he's dying, he comforts him. There is one great difference between life in the billets and life in the trenches. In billets, the soldier grouses often. In trenches, never. What he means by that is that when the soldiers are out of the line, they've got more time on their hands and they tend to grumble and moan. But when they're up the line, that doesn't happen. He says this may be partly due to a very proper sense of proportion. It may be due to the fact that the necessity for vigilance being relaxed and the occasions for industry few, life in billets is apt to become a great bore. The small Flemish and French towns offer few amenities. In our mess, we found our principal reaction in reunions with other fraternities at the patisserie. Of patisseries, that at Bethune is the best, that at Poppering the worst. Beside the former has a piano, and a most pleasing mademoiselle. Now, I read once that a soldier said that the war was 90% boredom and 10% terror. And in this article, our correspondence gives us some more evidence as that. He says, but it may well happen that in spite of babies and baths and brass bands and footballs and boxing gloves and playing marbles, the men get bored. The billets are often very crowded, and crowding may develop fastidious animosities. A man may tolerate shrapnel in the trenches, and yet may find his neighbour's table manners in billets positively intolerable. Men become stale or get on one another's nerves. When a company commander sees signs of this, he has one very potent prescription. He prescribes a good stiff route march. It's never been known to fail. Many a time in the winter months when out visiting divisional HQ did I, in the shameful luxury of my car, come across a battalion slogging along ruddy and cheerful in the mud and singing. Someone ought to make an anthology for private circulation only of the songs most affected by our men, and also of the limericks with which they beguile the long hours in the trenches. Even as I read those accounts, I can see those men marching along the sunken roads of the Somme, or the roads behind the lines at Poppering, whistling, singing, telling each other disgusting jokes, reading letters from home, anything to relieve the boredom that they talked about. And nothing much has changed, has it? Anyone who's been involved with any groups of boys or men in football teams or rugby teams or anything else knows that if these boys get bored, they do get on each other's nerves. Nothing has changed in over 100 years. And it never will it? Men will always be men. Now, I said at the beginning of reading that article from Brigadier General J.H. Morgan that he had a story that continues after the war had ended, after the fighting had ended, because he was part of the British delegation at the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, and then he was sent to Berlin between 1919 and 1923, and part of his role was to ensure that the Germans kept to the agreement that was made at the peace conference and that they wouldn't attempt to rearm, that Germany would actually disarm so they couldn't wage war. But Morgan could see that that wasn't happening and that the Germans were building up their army. It was contrary to the terms of that Treaty of Versailles. And he published his findings in October 1924. He wrote a document that said, "The disarmament of Germany and after." Morgan wrote, "Germany never disarmed, never intended to disarm, and for 7 years did everything in her power to obstruct, deceive and counter-control the commission whose duty it was to disarm her." But nobody listened to him. Perhaps nobody wanted to believe it, that the Germans were preparing once again for another war, which in many ways would be even more catastrophic than the Great War. Morgan retired from his army career in 1923, and he died in 1955 at the age of 79. I wonder if the British government and the other governments of Western Europe and the wider world, if they'd listened to his warnings in the 1920s, if the rise of Hitler had never occurred, would history have been different? Of course, it's another one of those questions that has no answer, we'll never know. Now, a few weeks ago, I was carrying out my duties as a volunteer for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, doing what they call the Eyes On, Hands On project. What I have to do with that is visit a number of cemeteries in North Norfolk in the east of England. And these aren't necessarily Commonwealth War Graves Commission burial grounds like you would see on the Western Front, but a number of small towns and villages where servicemen and women that had died at home are remembered or buried. And the commission used volunteers like myself to inspect these sometimes remote burial grounds twice a year. And what we have to do is simply take a photograph, clear the grave, the area around the grave, if it needs clearing, and clean it. Clean the headstone as well with just a natural brush and water. No chemicals these days are used on these headstones. And the other week, I entered the cemetery at a place called Beeston Regis, All Saints Church. And there's just two graves there that I have to look at. And the other difference is, when you're looking at headstones in the UK, is that unlike on the Western Front or anywhere else in the world, if a serviceman or woman died in the UK, the body was returned to the family and they could choose whether to have a Commonwealth War Graves Commission Portland headstone or whether to have a private headstone. And I noticed one which really did draw my attention in. I had to decide then and there, I had to find out more about this young man. It was a private headstone, a very grand one, and it said, "Here lies all that can die of Bert, Captain, 3rd Squadron, RAF, son of JC and E. James, from Semaphore in South Australia, killed May the 7th, 1918, aged 22 years. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." It made me think, this was a captain in the RAF, but he was from Australia. Why is he buried here in Norfolk? Well, I had to find out, and I want to share his story with you now. Well, his name was Bertie James, and he was born on the 8th of June, 1895, in Balaclava, in South Australia, to parents Joseph and Emily. Joseph, his father, had died in Perth in March of 1914, and on the 23rd of March 1916, James left Australia to join the Royal Flying Corps, as it was then called, and it became the Royal Air Force on the 1st of April 1918. A newspaper article back home in Adelaide tells us that Bert had been given a commission as a lieutenant in the RAF on the 10th of August 1916, and he'd gained his aviator certificate at a military school in Wiltshire. And in the same Adelaide newspaper called The Advertiser on the 10th of October 1916, I found a letter that Bert had written home. He called it a letter from the skies. From the unusual altitude of 6,000 feet above English soil, a young South Australian pilot, Bert James, addresses a letter to his mother. The letter is dated the 5th of August. He says, "I expect you'll be surprised to know I'm writing this 6,000 feet above Mother Earth. I'm with a friend of mine, quite a young fellow, who's just finished his course and is going to France. He is a fine pilot and it is just lovely here. We are going to Bournemouth, about 80 or 90 miles from home, having lunch there and coming back this afternoon. I'm getting on splendidly and think no more of going up by myself now than going in a car. I sat for my written examination on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, and I passed in everything. I've got to do one cross-country trip on my own, altogether about 6 hours flying, and then I'll get my wings as a first-class pilot. That will be in 10 days' time, and I expect to go to France shortly after. We can see the sea now, and it's getting interesting. It's a bit bumpy up here, and the engine is vibrating a good deal." Bert was then sent down to a place called RAF Joyce Green, which is near Dartford in Kent in the southeast of England. But it was to be not quite 2 years later, by now promoted to captain, that Bert was killed in an accident within sight of that airfield near Dartford, as a result of his plane and another one, another British plane, colliding in mid-air. There was a court of inquiry. It says, "The court, having considered the evidence, are of the opinion that the accidents in which Captain James and Second Lieutenant Nash were killed was due to the following causes: that the Avro C-4477 collided with Avro B8707 when in mid-air, about 2,000 feet up, both being engaged in practicing aerial fighting. It also found both machines crashed to the ground out of control, causing instantaneous death to Captain James and Nash and Ward. Bert was buried in Beeston Regis, probably too far for him to go back to Australia. And it's believed that he was buried there because he did have some family members or relatives that lived in the area. There's no evidence of that, though. And that Advertiser newspaper back home in Adelaide on the 28th of May 1918 gives us more information about what Bert had done whilst he'd been serving with the RFC and the REF. He said he was sent to France, flying over the lines for 12 months. On July the 17th, 1917, he'd come down some thousands of feet and smashed his machine, but got out with a shaking. 2 days later, on July the 19th, he got another come down, landed in a shell hole, wrecked his machine again, hurt his knee and received a shock. Then he was sent to England for a rest. Whilst there, he became a captain. He was made an instructor, and while the commanding officer was on leave, Captain James was put in his place, being in charge of 50 officers and 300 men. He showed great skill in the short time he was in charge. Captain James, in writing home in all his letters, expressed his great pleasure in his occupation. He thoroughly enjoyed his work. Another newspaper in the UK gave us more detailed information about how the accident occurred. It says that two pilots and observer were killed in a collision between two aeroplanes, which occurred over Dartford on Tuesday night. The accident was witnessed by a large number of people, the machines having been performing evolutions over the town for some time. Shortly before 8 o'clock, the aeroplanes came into collision. One was seen to nosedive to the ground. Captain James had acted as an instructor at the aerodrome for about 2 months. Must have been an awful time for his mum back home in South Australia. Don't forget, she'd become a widow in 1914 and now she'd lost her young son. And in that local newspaper in Adelaide, she wrote a short poem which was published on the first anniversary of his death. It says, "You're always in my thoughts, dear Bert. It is sweet to breathe your name. In life I loved you dearly. In death I do the same. I mourn for you, dear Bert, but not with outward show, for those who mourn sincerely mourn silently and low." And then exactly a year later, she wrote again about Bert. She says, "You have taken him, O beautiful England, my only and loving son. A broken life is all I have here, in silent grief and often a tear. No human eye can ever trace the sadness behind a smiling face." Beeston Regis in Norfolk is a beautiful place, and where Bert is at rest is overlooking the sea. It's highly unlikely that his mum ever got to see his grave, but every time I go to his grave twice a year, as required to do so by the commission, I put my hand on his headstone and I think not just of him, but his mum as well. And again, by listening to this story, we ensure that Captain Bert James's memory continues forever and ever. And now we go back to the Somme. And there was a war correspondent, official war correspondent, who became quite famous. And his name was Philip Gibbs. And he was there during the Battle of the Somme, and has written a number of fascinating accounts of what he saw, most of them after the fighting had moved on. Now, people will know that the 1st of July 1916 was, of course, a complete disaster in most places, and there's more casualties on that day than any other day in the history of the British Army. But in the southern part of the battlefield, around the villages of Montauban and Carnoy, there was success, and indeed the German-held village of Montauban, sitting on a ridge, as they always did, overlooking the British Army, was taken that morning. And it was a few days later that Gibbs himself went up to what was left of Montauban and went into some of those deep dugouts that we talk about that are still beneath our feet on the Western Front. He describes what he found in those deep defensive positions that the Germans had spent nearly 2 years preparing. He said it is behind the lines on the outskirts of the battlefield that one sees most of the activity of war. As I saw it today when I went up to the captured ground of Montauban. Up there, where fighting was in progress, not many men were visible. Until the advance, after the work of our guns and the short, sharp rush from open ground under the enemy's shrapnel, our men are hidden, and the only movement to be seen is that of the shells bursting and tossing up the earth. But on the way up, now that the war is no longer stationary, there is a great turmoil of men and mules and guns and wagons. Great camps have been assembled in the dips and hollows of the hills, with painted tents between the lines and great masses of horses and wagons and gun limbers crowded together with thousands of men busy as ants. Transport columns came down or went up the hilly roads driven by tired men who dropped in their seats or saddles after 3 days of battle in which they have had but little sleep. One of them was asleep today. He'd fallen backwards in his wagon, still holding the reins, and while he slept his horses jogged on steadily following the leaders of the column. On the roadside and among the wild flowers of uncultivated fields, batches of infantry who'd been marching all night had flung themselves down and slept, also while they had half hour's chance, with their arms outstretched, with their rifles and packs for their pillows. Other men were moving up towards the fighting lines, marching with a steady tramp along the chalky roads, which plastered them with white dust from steel helmet downwards, and put a white mask upon their faces, except where the sweat came down in gullies. At wayside corners were field dressing stations flying the Red Cross flag and surrounded by little parks of ambulances where stretcher men were busy. And every now and then, at a crossroads or a bypath, a wooden notice board directed the way in red letters with the words, "Walking Wounded." But of course, as he got closer to the battlefield from a few days earlier, he saw men that were beyond help. He says closer to the lines there was a scene which would make one weep if one had the weakness of tears after 2 years of war. Our dead were being buried in a newly made cemetery, and some of their comrades were standing by the open graves and sorting out the crosses, the little wooden crosses which grow in such a harvest across these fields of France. They were white above the brown earth and put into neat rows, and labelled with strips of tin bearing the names of those who now have peace. French troops were mingled amongst our men, a working party of them shouldering picks and shovels. They were territorials past the fighting age, but tall, sturdy, hardened men, with a likeness to their young sons who, with less weight but with the same hard bronze look, are fighting the new battles of the war. He then says, "I passed our old lines of trenches from which on Saturday morning our men went out cheering to that great attack which carried them to the farthest point gained that day in spite of heavy losses. The trenches now were filled with litter collected from the battlefield, stacks of rifles and kit, piles of hand grenades no longer needed by those who owned them. The old system of trenches, in which French troops lived for many months of war before they handed them over to our men, was like a ruined and deserted town left hurriedly because of plague and in great disorder. Letters were lying about, and bully beef tins and cartridge clips. Our men had gone forward, and these old trenches are abandoned." It is beyond the power of words to give a picture of the German trenches over this battlefield of Montauban, where we now hold the line through the wood beyond. Before last Saturday, it was a wide and far-reaching network of trenches, with many communication ways and strong traverses and redoubts. It was a great underground fortress, which any body of men could have held against any others for all time, apart from the destructive power of heavy artillery. Why now, it was the most frightful convulsion of earth that the eyes of man could see. The bombardment by our guns had tossed all these earthworks into vast rubbish heaps. We had made this ground one series of shell craters, so deep and so broad that it was like a field of extinct volcanoes. The ground rose and fell in enormous waves of brown earth, so that standing above one crater, I saw before me these solid billows with 30 feet slopes stretching away like a sea frozen after a great storm. We'd hurled thousands of shells from our heaviest howitzers and long-range guns into this stretch of field. I saw here and touched here the awful result of the great gunfire which I'd watched from the centre of our batteries on the morning of July the 1st. That bombardment had annihilated the German position. Even many of the dugouts going 30 feet deep below the earth and strongly timbered and cemented had choked with masses of earth, so that many dead bodies lie buried there. But some had been left in spite of the upheaval of earth around them, and into some of these I crept down, impelled by the strong, grim spell of those little dark rooms below where German soldiers lived until only a few days ago. The dugouts were haunted. They seemed haunted by the spirits of the men who had made their homes here and had carried into these holes the pride of their souls and any poetry they had in their hearts and their hopes and terrors and memories of love and life in the good world of peace. I could not resist going down to such places, though to do so gave me goose flesh. I had to go warily, for on the stairways were unexploded bombs of the hairbrush style. What he means by that is the German stick bomb with a wooden handle and the explosives at one end. A stumble or a kick might send one to eternity by high explosive force, and it was difficult not to stumble, for the steps were broken or fallen into a landslide. Down inside, the little square rooms were filled with the relics of German officers and men. The deal tables were strewn with papers. On the wooden bedsteads lay blue-grey overcoats, wine bottles, photograph albums, furry haversacks, boots, belts, kits of every kind had been tumbled together by the British soldiers who'd come here after the first rush to the enemy trenches and search for men in hiding. There were men in hiding now, though harmless. In one of the dugouts where I groped my way down, it was pitch dark. I stumbled against something and fumbled for my matches. When I struck a light, I saw in the corner of a room a German. He lay curled up, with his head on his arm as though asleep. I did not stay to look at his face, but went up quickly. And yet I went down others and lingered in one where no corpse lay because of the tragic spirit that dwelt there, and put its spell on me. I picked up some letters. They were all written to dear brother Wilhelm from sisters and brothers, sending him their loving greetings, praying that his health was good, promising to send him gifts of food and yearning for his homecoming. "Since your last letter and card," said one of them, "we've heard nothing more from you. Every time the postman comes, we hope for a little note from you. Dear Wilhelm, in order to be patient with your fate, you must thank God because you've found fortune in misfortune." Poor, pitiful letters. I was ashamed to read them because it seemed like prying into another man's secrets, although he was dead. There was a little book I picked up. It is a book of soldiers' songs, full of old German sentiments about the little mother and the old house at home and the pretty girl who kissed her soldier boy before he went off to war. I stood again above ground in the shell craters. Other shells were coming over my head with their indescribable whooping, and the black shrapnel was still bursting about the fields, and the Germans were dropping 5.9 shells along a line 100 yards away. "Be careful about those dugouts," said an officer. "Some of them have charged mines inside, and there may be Germans still hiding in them." Two Germans were found hiding there today. Some of our men found themselves being sniped, and after a search found that the shots were coming from a certain section of trench in which there were communicating dugouts. They isolated one dugout in which the snipers were concealed. "Come out of that," shouted our men. "Surrender like good boys." But the only answer they had was a shot. The dugout was bombed. But the men went through an underground passage into another one. Then a charge of ammonol was put down and the dugout blown to bits. This afternoon, while I was still on the battlefield of Montauban, a great thunderstorm broke. It was sudden and violent, and the rain fell in sheets. The sky became black with a greenish streak in it when the lightning forked over the high wooded ridges towards La Boisselle and above Fricourt Wood. "Heaven's artillery," said an officer, and his words were not flippant. There was something awe-inspiring in the darkness that closed in upon these battlefields and the great rolls of thunder that mingled with the noise of the guns. Artillery observation was impossible, but the guns still fired and their flashes were as vivid as the lightning, revealing through the murk the dark figures of marching men and the black woods slashed with shellfire just above Montauban. In a little while, the low-lying ground was flooded, so the guns in the valleys were in water and the horse transports splashed through ponds, scattering fountains above their axles, and rivers ran down the broken trenches of the old German line. I stood in the storm, watching this scene of war, and the gloom and terror of it closed about me. I think listening to those words of a professional journalist really takes me back to my opening comments at the beginning of this episode, where I've said that even after all these years of visiting the battlefields, reading and telling the stories of the men that were there, I still got no comprehension, no understanding of what it was like. How can you have? And I think this final passage that I read just a couple of days ago also puts those thoughts of mine into even more focus. They were spoken by a British veteran, a British soldier in the First World War called Len Thompson, and he was describing the dead bodies that littered the trenches and into no man's land as well. He says in ordinary warfare, the bodies went back with the gun carriages that brought up the rations, but now there were hundreds, thousands, not merely ours, but German as well. Out in no man's land, the sun swelled up the dead with gas and often turned them blue, almost navy blue. Then, when the gas escaped, the bodies dried up like mummies and were frozen in their death positions. Sitting bodies, kneeling bodies, bodies in almost every position, though most lay on their bellies or on their backs. The crows picked out the eyes, and rats lived on bodies that lay in abandoned dugouts. These rats were very large and quite fearless, their familiarity with the dead having made them contemptuous of the living. One night, one fell on my face in a dugout and bit me. Where we fought several times over the same ground, bodies became incorporated in the material of the trenches themselves. They were putrid, with the consistency of Camembert cheese. I once fell and put my right hand through the belly of a man. It was days before I could get the smell out of my nails. Even worse was that each one was crawling with maggots and covered inches deep with a black fur of flies which flew up into your face, mouth, eyes and nostrils. That really is a scene from hell, isn't it? I don't know what you're like listening to it, but just reading it makes me feel nauseous, as I suppose they did when they were witnessing those scenes. And you can just imagine it could have been written about the battlefields of the Somme, those beautiful, enormous fields, not enclosed like the fields are here in England, almost like prairies. They seem to go on forever and ever when you visit there now. It's so peaceful. We say so many times, to be Len Thompson or any of his comrades, is there any wonder why they didn't want to talk to their families about it when they returned home? Is there any wonder that some didn't talk about it at all? They didn't claim their medals, even stories of some of them throwing their medals away. Some did speak about it when they reached old age. People like Harry Patch, the last fighting Tommy, only spoke about it when he reached the age of a century. I think some of the accounts that we've read today give us that understanding of what it was like, but are the reasons why those veterans didn't talk about it. Now, we normally sound the last post, but some of these stories this week don't relate to individual soldiers that died. And again, I can't explain why, but I wanted to do something different. And if you cast our mind back a few years to the days of COVID, there was a former British Army officer called Captain Sir Tom Moore that raised hundreds of thousands of pounds for the National Health Service. And he joined forces with the famous singer Michael Ball and one of the choirs from the National Health Service themselves. And they sang a hymn which is well known to football supporters, particularly those from Liverpool, "You'll Never Walk Alone." And it's those voices that I wanted to end this week's podcast.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark. At the end of the storm, there's a golden sky and sweet to the song of the lark.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark.
At the end of the storm, there's a golden sky and a sweet silver song of the lark. Walk on through the wind, walk on through the rain, though your dreams be tossed and blown. Walk on, walk on, walk on with hope in your heart, and your
walk on through the wind,
walk on
through.